This is the Human Action Podcast with your hosts, Jeff Deist and Dr. Bob Murphy.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back once again to the Human Action Podcast. Start off this week with a bit of sad news. We lost our great friend and colleague, Dr. Yuri Maltsev at Carthage College earlier this week. So this show, I guess, in part is dedicated to him and all the work he'd tried to do in bringing some degree of economic or fiscal sanity to the former Soviet Union. And then, of course, when he defected to the United States, becoming just an absolute monster over here. We all remember his stories, remember him from conferences, and he was just an absolute sweetheart and a brilliant man to boot. So we'll be missing him. But with Yuri in mind, I want to welcome, obviously, my co-host, Dr. Bob Murphy, and also Dr. Per Bielan from Oklahoma State University. Many of you are familiar with him, not only as a senior fellow at the Mises Institute, but because of this, his recent new book, How to Think About the Economy, which I think may be the most important book of the 21st century at this point, because that's really the topic of our show, gentlemen. Just following Per and others on Twitter, I've noticed that there really is a growing sense of what I would call economics denialism, this idea that economics isn't real. There are no laws of economics the way there are, let's say, in physics with gravity, that economics is simply something that can be commanded by legislative or regulatory fiat, and we don't really have to think of it as any kind of real science. And so given the degree of economics ignorance in this country, most people don't get it in high school. Most non-business majors get barely any, maybe an elective, in their undergraduate curriculum. It seems like we are in a point now where economics has become a political exercise. And I'm beginning to wonder, as a lay person, you two are the economists, whether economics is doing any good. So with that sort of broad introduction, let's open it to Per for a response.
Well, the very short answer to that question is that not really. But I think there are really two aspects to it. One is the teaching, and what are we actually teaching the students? And we're teaching them methods, and we're teaching them a toolkit for basically analyzing statistics and assessing policies and predicting outcomes. I mean, that's what economics is for. And then economics, or economists professionally, I mean, most of them, I would think, they're hired by the government to run data analyses, data mining, and also for big corporations like insurance companies and things like that. So they're really just glorified applied statisticians in a sense.
Yeah, if I could, I'm wondering, Per, if I could ask you to see, because to me, Jeff, like I think when you ask that question, yeah, it depends what you mean. In terms of like graduate programs churning out new professional economists, yeah, I agree with Per if that's what he's saying, that's not, I mean, it's, you know, I used to joke when I would interact with grad students, like to say, you know, when they would come out and pitch a paper idea to me, and I would say, well, how many stars do you have in the regression table? You know, because that would like show you how significant the result was in terms of, and it was a joke, meaning like it, you know, it has nothing to do with the theory or whatever. It's just, hey, can you get this regression result in the statistical software, come back and say it's statistically significant? And then, oh, if it is, then you can get it published. And if not, then go back and do something else, you know, and keep changing the data and what you're doing until you get those at least one star. And so, but in terms of like the Mises faculty who are out there who have teaching positions and they're teaching Econ 201 or something to people, and it's the first time those students who are undergrads have ever heard, oh, wait a minute, there might be a downside to the minimum wage. And, well, gee, what if we had the minimum wage at $50 an hour? Never even thought of that. Or doesn't the government just print a bunch of money and make everyone trillionaires? Can we see how that actually wouldn't be a good idea? So if someone gets one semester of introductory economics from a free market economist, I think that's definitely a good thing, just like, you know, they should probably learn some intro to philosophy and, you know, learn the basics of evolutionary theory from a biologist and whatever. Like, you should know the basics of market economics, and that's probably a good thing that it's somewhat holding the public back from completely embracing Bernie Sanders. But yeah, in terms of the profession as a whole, I'm just astonished at, like, we're arguing over the $1 trillion platinum coin.
Right, but the profession as a whole, or the discipline as a whole, I would say, it's not just objective truth seeking, right? I mean, it's a profession or a discipline ought to make us happier, healthier, wiser, richer, right? And one of the criticisms I see levied at economics because of this distinction between a social and a physical science is that, well, you know, economics is just opinions because there's schools of thought. There aren't schools of thought in physics. You know, there are Marxist economists, there are free market economists. So how can this be a real science if people don't even agree on the fundamental tenets?
I think is what you said about physics or really the natural sciences versus the social sciences. There are two issues there too. One big problem is that economics is trying to be a natural science. It's not actually a social science. And the other is, yeah, there are schools of thought, but in economics, I don't know if economists are economizing on the schools of thought or something like that, but it's really when you're studying economics, there is only one. I mean, yeah, there's micro and macro, but there you don't get different perspectives on it. Whereas if you take courses in, say, sociology, you have different theoretical frameworks that give you different types of insights. Of course, in sociology, you might not get a whole lot of insight at all, but at least they contribute in different ways, right? But if you take economics, they will teach you economics, and they will pretend that that's it. There's no history. There's no history of economic thought. There are no different perspectives. Some students might know about Austrian economics, but their professors typically will not, so they will just shut down that discussion. All you can do is then go to what is core, which is really the graphs and the math.
Yeah, I guess I'm largely agreeing with Per, but my angle would be a little bit different. So I agree that I think what happens, Jeff, is that if there's like in physics, for example, my understanding is there are schools of thought like in terms of like, oh, what do we think about string theory? Or are there multiple universes? When there's things where we don't yet have the ability experimentally to go test and see the divergence between, well, this school of thought would say this, you'd see this result and this would say that. But then once the experiments come in, then one side wins and one side loses. And, you know, largely people go down that route unless they think, you know, there was a mistake in the way the experiment was conducted. And so I think that's what their charge against the economists would be, is to say, gosh, you can't even agree on what caused the Great Depression or not. And, you know, I think somebody like Mises or Hayek or Rothbard would say, right, because there's so many different variables, you can't really have a controlled experiment in the social sciences. But like Per is saying, the dominant paradigm that's gotten a hold of the curricula at the various, especially at the graduate level, would say, yes, you can. And that's why we're doing all the stuff that I was making fun of 5 minutes ago, that we want to make it rigorous. So there's a fact of the matter. And does the minimum wage cause unemployment? Well, we don't know. Maybe it doesn't. Let's go look at the numbers and see. I don't want to have my ideological prior. So it to the extent that they force themselves to mimic the physical sciences, then yeah, there is, you know, there aren't schools of thought, but as you know, I agree with like Mises to say that's actually because they're perverting what economics should be.
Right. It's trying to be an inductive empirical science that it really has a history of being a deductive body of theory. And that's of course going to screw things up. And it's, I think it's going step by step and rather quickly, further and further into this inductive empiricism rather than anything else, which is exactly the issue then with such things as the Great Depression, that you have economists and they will go through troves of data and they will find different things that they find to be significant, statistically significant in their database or their data set. And then you can just add variables and that maybe another graduate student or maybe a cohort of graduate students will collect more data and do some fancy data manipulation to extend the database. And then you find another variable that is significant. And that's also an explanation then. And there's really nothing in this data mining that steers or directs your attention. So as Austrians, we would say, well, this is what we know. This is the theory, and that's true. If some other outcome than what we would expect happened, then we will need to look at what other things did we not consider, what other things could have affected this. But it's not the case that suddenly the demand curves slope upwards or whatever. The theory is still the case, but economists are starting with sort of the theory that they learn in economics 101, and then they go to empirics and statistical manipulations and regressions, and they try to find these correlations. And those correlations can somehow be used to reject the theory, but only to some extent. So they're sort of they're very confused methodologically and theoretically, because they're trying to be both deductive and inductive at the same time, even though I think they're definitely going for induction in a sort of physics sense.
Well, elaborate on that. I see you jousting on Twitter. What is the role of empiricism in economics properly, in your view?
Well, properly, it's about describing specific events and what actually happened. So if you look at the Great Depression, to continue that example, then you should try to figure out exactly what happened and elaborate on that specific period of time and what was going on. But we already know things about the business cycle. For instance, the theory tells us that, well, if you expand credit and so forth, we know this, but what exactly happened and in what order did it happen? What companies and what sectors of the economy were affected? Things like that. Those are things that the theory cannot really tell us. But we do know that when you expand credit, the money will end up in a certain sector first or before other sectors, and that will cause a boom-bust cycle and so forth. But which ones and what directed them there and what actually caused, say, the housing crisis, what actually made it a housing crisis and not a crisis somewhere else? That's where we should look at the data.
Yeah. If I could jump in on that too, to give some specifics. So like the basic deductive theory, a priori stuff that we know just through introspection from the fact that humans act and so on, we could conclude other things equal, raising the minimum wage will cause more unemployment than there otherwise would have been. Right. So even there, it doesn't mean the measured rate of unemployment goes up, because for all we know, there could be some other trend that was kicking in that would have made the unemployment rate drop to, 1%, but instead it only fell to 2% because they raised the minimum wage. There's things like that. We can know that, yes, other things equal, expansion of credit and artificially lowering interest rates will cause an unsustainable boom. But like going into 2008, both those things happened, right? I think it was legislatively done under the George W. Bush administration. I don't know if it actually kicked it. I think it like phased in that the minimum wage was raised stepwise fashion, I think at the end of Bush and starting Obama. And then, of course, there was the credit expansion and contraction. And so to say, well, the financial crisis of 2008, maybe that was entirely due to raising the minimum wage, right? Like the theory wouldn't tell you, and my judgment is no, that wasn't just the minimum wage. There's all kinds of, but you would need numbers and things to try to explain, well, how do you assign a particular event to, a cause when you just kind of know a priori that these things, other things equal, lead to these effects? How do you assign, magnitudes? That's the kind of stuff where numbers and studying the past would clearly come into play.
But doesn't it seem that theory is pretty dead in the economics profession? No one's writing treatises, for example. Or does that mean that the theory is agreed upon? It feels to me like if you look at, for example, recent Nobel Prize winners in economics, that's all applied stuff, behavioral stuff, Richard Thaler or Thaler, you have Ben Bernanke for some of his work on banking crises. I mean, it doesn't look like there's much theory, at least among the Nobel set.
Yeah. I think part of the problem there is also that theory nowadays in economics is more or less just mathematical modeling. So when you develop theory and you're a theorist, quote unquote, in economics, you're doing math and you don't really need any relevance or connection to the real world. So you just need to find a juicy problem in the math pretty much, and then you just produce mathematical proofs or theorems and whatnot else to try to solve that in some sense, which of course makes it very, very narrow and not necessarily applicable at all. I mean, in terms of the theory that we do as Austrians, I don't think any economist does that or even thinks about it, because it's been so long since we actually taught the history of economic thought and actually the ideas behind it. And we've even lost track of what was the original problem, right? When even Adam Smith's treatise, it's an inquiry into the nature and causes of the wealth of nations. It's about where does prosperity come from? That was the problem that he was trying to address and that most economists have been looking at since then. I mean, it's value creation and value distribution in society. How does this thing work? Mm-hmm. And that's not really part of it anymore. Economists are, they dig through troves of data and they try to get a career in assessing policies pretty much. I mean, they assist policymakers in making predictions. I think that is the core of what economists do nowadays.
Yeah, I would say, Jeff, in response to what you had, so if you guys remember in the beginning, in his like introduction, or I think it was the introduction, or maybe it was chapter one of Man, Economy, and State, Rothbard laments how the economic treatise has died. You know, you gotta go back to like Wicksteed or something. And that, so he wrote that in the 50s, and it came out, what, like 61, 62, something like that. So even as of then, Rothbard was trying to, you know, blow on these dying embers to keep the flame alive of the such a thing as a comprehensive trade. And then he was lamenting how there's labor economists, there's trade economists, there's, you know, industry organization economists, and they're all, and it's sort of like, you know, how it, like in medicine that there's a pulmonologist and a cardiologist, like that's what economics was turning into. And he was lamenting that because he was saying, how can you understand international trade if you don't like have just a, you know, understand the basics of or to just dive into labor market analysis if you're not really a generalist? It doesn't make sense in economics. And I would agree with that. And the situation has just gotten worse. And like Per's saying, let me just make sure the listeners get this. Like, I went to NYU in what, the early 2000s, and I think it's probably still like this. When they would teach the standard workhorse model for like macro analysis and to model central banks, it was they assumed there was one. They called him an agent, not even a person, who had consumer preferences and lived forever. And then there was a central bank and maybe there was a firm or something. And that was it. And there was no reason to even hold money in the model. You had to use some kind of trick to make it that someone would want to hold money, because in the world of the model, the assumptions, there was no reason you wouldn't need money because you know everything. And then they would figure out what's optimal Fed policy in that kind of a framework. It was really, you know, it took a while to get my head around it. Like, so when people hear, oh, they use models, they're probably thinking of these real complex computer simulations, like from the climate change literature. And no, it's not like that. It's really stripped down to make it tractable. That's the word they use. So it's, I think people would be stunned if they saw just how bare bones this stuff was in order to be able to quote, solve the model.
Okay, but if a layperson were listening and said, well, okay, guys, but what would I get? How would I benefit from understanding economics more theoretically? What's the point of axioms? What's the point of deduction? What's the point of praxeology? It seems to me it makes more sense to go out and study minimum wage rules and see what actually happens in the real world. I mean, I know you both get this all the time.
Yeah, we do. And I think that it part of it, this is, I think, a very broad brainwashing of people into believing that the scientific method, not that there's more than one, there's only the scientific method that's almost trademarked, and that's the only way of getting knowledge about anything at all. Of course, if you talk to philosophers of science, they're way over Popper. They've moved on since decades, right? But the rest of us, in sort of popular understanding of how to generate knowledge, it's all about the scientific method. And then it's all about producing a hypothesis. People don't really know where hypotheses come from, so they just think, oh, you can pull whatever you like out of your ass, and then you just go to the data and you test it. And then you'll see, was it true or not? And then it's sort of binary. And none of that is true at all. And if philosopher of science wouldn't listen to you at all, but if they would, they would just laugh at you, right? And especially when we're talking about human agency, then it's different. You can't just test these things. And I talk to my students a lot about these things too, and they get it intuitively that, well, if you were to test things, let's say I put rocks next to each other on a cliff and I just push down the first rock and I study how fast does it fall, what's the impact and whatnot else. And I do the next one and I just compare, and then it's repeatable. You can do the same thing. And then I say, I take you, my students, and I put you on that cliff. And I push the first one over the cliff, and I study what happens and how you react and everything like that. And I push the second one, and already there, everybody sees that this is nonsense. Because obviously the second one is not just going to stand there and wait for me to push him over the edge. And even if I could use just one student and pick him up again and say he's not harmed, so I pick him up and put him on the edge again and see if it's the same with the same student. No, he's going to punch me or run away or something like that. He's going to change his behavior because he learned something. So you can't really use the same types of experiments on people. It doesn't work like that.
It's funny, Fair. I just assumed you were going to say that would be unethical. And your point was, no, I mean, I would be willing to push my students over. Just eventually they'd start resisting. So, but to concretely answer that too, Jeff, like the specific literal answer when you say, you know, comes the minimum wage. Yeah, I mean, there is a certain appeal, right? To say, I don't want to go in with my dogma and my, you know, pro-business ideology that, you know, that the capitalist fat cats are paying for their kept, you know, mouthpieces at the universities to be telling the public and scaring them with, you know, all these fears of unemployment. Let's just go look at the numbers and see. Well, the problem is you can have reputable economists who do, you know, meta analyses of the literature, and one who's pro minimum wage will say, here we assess the literature and we reviewed 100 studies and blah, blah, blah. And the overwhelming consensus was for modest increases in the minimum wage, there's little effect on unemployment. And in fact, there's many cases where it somehow looked like unemployment went down. And so, and here are some theoretical mechanisms by which that could have happened. Maybe it boosted.
Okay.
And then other economists will say the opposite. So it's like economists can't even agree on what the literature says, let alone to say, what do you actually think's going on? Like, so it's, and they're not lying. Like, but I'm saying there's so many bells and whistles that they're not even lying.
But isn't that pro minimum wage economist effectively saying demand curves don't slope downward? Isn't he effectively challenging the theory itself?
I'll do a quick one and then parallel. Let's see. I can't even answer that, Jeff, because I've seen different ones say different things. So, because there's different ways to handle it. Because again, the demand curve means other things equal. And so it depends what are you including in that umbrella phrase. And if it's stuff like you feel better working for an employer that cares about you and you're motivated, well then, you know what I'm saying? So
a lot of people think other things equal is the Austrian cop-out.
Right. And so again, when it comes to stuff like this, though, there's so many different moving parts. And like Para was saying, you can't have a controlled experiment, you know, in this kind of stuff. You can't just.
But you know what I mean. You know what I mean? Devil's advocate is like, look, Austrians, we're trying to figure out what happens if we raise minimum wage. And if you guys can only tell me all things equal, everything's never equal. There's always a million variables. Right. So what good are you guys? And tell me when Tesla stock's going to peak so I can sell it.
Right. So on the other things equal, again, I'm saying, it's just a frank assessment saying this is the situation. We don't have controlled experiments because, like Per's saying, at the very least, people would learn, like they would see the other experiments, whereas, you know, atoms don't learn from, you know, repeated experiments, and so they don't change their behavior accordingly. And so it's that's the only technique we have is to say, well, all we can do is hold things and just think through the implications, and then that we accumulate. Mm-hmm. And so then we start knowing, you know, 5, 6, 7, 18 different results. And then that might give us judgment in a particular situation. I mean, so I understand why that seems unsatisfactory, but if that's the situation, you don't improve it by saying, okay, so let's just pretend people are like, you know, molecules and go ahead and move them around like pieces on a chessboard.
Yeah, but there's more to it too, right? I mean, it's not like we're saying it, that it's only hold everything held constant, and that means that everything is random, right? What we're really uncovering with the theory is that there are mechanisms in place and things will lead to other things. But then there might be other effects as well. I mean, so it's not that like studying economic theory will just make you say, oh, well, something else happened. Oh, I can't say anything at all. Because raising the minimum wage above the market wage will cause higher unemployment than otherwise would have been the case. But it could be something else happens at the very same time. And we need to account for that too. But we know that there is already a pressure towards higher unemployment. So we need an even stronger effect to counter that, right? So it's, you can, of course, I mean, Bob mentioned before that you can't look at before and after only. You have to look at after and versus the counterfactual, what would have happened. And sometimes there's a big change that you can identify and it's pretty easy, even though you have this pressure on. I mean, I use an example with my students with the minimum wage because they typically are in favor of the minimum wage and raising it, fight for 15 and that sort of thing.
Sure.
And I say, well, you can't really say that it didn't cause more unemployment. And I use the example of here in Stillwater, Oklahoma. I mean, a small college town, 40,000 people or something. Let's say we just implement $50 an hour as minimum wage. And then they go, well, that's a little much. And I'm like, well, why not? And then I say, well, what happens if at the same time that this goes into effect, Apple moves their headquarters to Stillwater, Oklahoma? And they bring some people and they hire people. How many of you think that you in Apple's headquarters, you make less than $50 an hour? Isn't it the case you're going to have a whole lot more jobs and a whole lot more well-paying jobs in Stillwater, Oklahoma after the minimum wage has been jacked up, but it happens to be because Apple moved there. And we know it's because Apple moved there because that's the big change that happened other than the minimum wage, right? If you just look at the data, you can't really say which was which.
So what are the incentives for economists? I mentioned the Nobel tends to go to a certain type of category more than theoretical thinking. We know that people want tenure. They'd like to have an academic sinecure. They might like a high-paying job at the Fed or with Amazon or something else as an economist. But in other words, what are the incentives and how do they affect what economists do all day? In other words, are they incentivized to do things which we would view as not core economics or even counter to core economics?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, why does anybody go into economics to begin with? I mean, that's the question. And now when you're introduced to anything economics, I think a lot of people, they start to study economics because they're looking for a certain type of career. And very often economists are well known for being very, very good at analyzing data and running statistical analyses. And if you want that kind of job, and there will always be those kinds of jobs because businesses, I mean, they can't rely completely on prediction, but they can at least weed out really stupid ideas using data. Maybe they will miss something great, but usually at least they will stay away from obvious losses, right? So it's a little bit, it's not precise enough for science, but it's precise enough for running a business. So they can get a career doing that, which means they're really just interested in getting the tools. They're not social theorists or social philosophers in any sense. And most students are exposed to economics because they have to take Econ 101, mm-hmm. micro and macro. And in both courses, well, they're complete turnoffs for two reasons. And one is that it's a lot of math and the diagrams, and you shift curves back and forth, and no one really knows what the heck is going on and why that applies or when or anything like that. And it's typically, at least at the big research universities, it's taught by a first-year graduate student. And I mean, whoever is turned on by this sort of thing is a peculiar individual, to say the least, right? And it's someone who's interested in the math and not interested in anything else.
Right.
And if you go to grad school, then having an undergraduate degree in math, that will make you the star in grad school.
Yeah, I mean, I've certainly heard anecdotally a lot of people talking about the really incredible 700-800 level math which is required of PhD students today in most programs. And as a result, a lot of Asian students who were very strong in their K-12 programs math-wise tend to go into those programs. I also hear anecdotally, as to your point about job training, Per, I mean, econ PhDs are a relative bright spot in the employment market versus, let's say, a lot of PhDs in the social science or history where jobs are just very, very difficult to come by. So there is an incentive, I guess, a proper one that you can actually go get a job at Amazon or something with an econ PhD these days for the most part.
If I could chime in on that one, so I left Hillsdale and then I was going over and we were going to relocate to the New York City area and I was trying to get a job, you know, whether it was literally Wall Street or just something related. And there was a bank that had a spot for people to analyze the mortgage market or something like that. And I got the guy on the phone and it was like a job interview. And he was going over my background. Okay, PhD from NYU. Did it. And then he goes, oh, you have a degree in economics? And I said, yeah. And he said, sorry, I thought you had a PhD in finance. He goes, you economists, you think the housing market's rational. It's not. And he hung up the phone. And so, but I mean, I understood where he was coming from because like even there, you know what I mean? So he wasn't lamenting that I was an Austrian economist. He just meant that I know the way you economists model the housing market. Every consumer, you know, refinances the moment that it saves money in terms of present value calculation, blah, blah, blah. And that's not when people refinance. I just know it's not. It's more emotional, that kind of stuff. And so they didn't want any economists filling this role because they just assume people are rational and that's not how it is. So anyway, I'm just saying that you're right. It's better to have an econ PhD than a history one. But even there was a bad taste in a lot of people's mouths mm-hmm. from economists.
Right. But if we're going to talk about how economics ought to work or function as a profession and how it ought to help people, I think we have to look at the incentives, right? Are there incentives to perform that kind of work? And if there aren't, because tenure is moribund, because universities are captured by progressives, because government institutions and banks, which are almost quasi-government institutions at this point, are full of single track modeling statistical type people. I mean, that's something that we, I think we have to think about and address and grapple with. I mean, as a lay person, I want to have the best economy we can in America. I want to have the most material prosperity we can have. And if economic, if the profession's working counter to that, then we have a problem.
Let me give a quick example, and then I'll just try to keep it short, Per, so you can talk too. It's here's right, like in terms of macro and central banks and monetary policy. If someone has a new working paper talking about, oh, what I think the Fed should do is target to increase, you know, real worker median wages to rise at 3.7% a year. Lots of people would be willing to have them fly in and present that to their faculty at lunch or whatever at a seminar. But if someone just says, no, I don't think central banks should exist, free market for the win. And every example you can bring me of a, you know, central bank, I have a paper just showing 50 examples of central banks who cause problems. It's not merely ideological. People would just say, well, that's kind of a negative result. We can't do anything with that. We're not going to abolish the central bank next week. So what's the point of us even? Who cares? You might be right, but it doesn't. It's not relevant. We need to like tweak our tools and maybe give new guidance to the central bankers. And let's think about this. And it's more fun to grapple with this new rule that's being proposed, not just we're you know, harming the patient, you know, do no harm. So that's kind of, so if you're saying you couldn't, it'd be hard to make a career, Jeff, out of just being Dr. No. In academia, because that's what people are like, well, what are we going to do with that? You know, kind of like there's no point in publishing more literature if it's just we should stop doing this.
Well, it's hard to be Dr. No in politics, too, right?
Right. That's why I said that.
some have experience of. I think the proper role of economics is not really to be a specialized sort of in-between education either. So I think economics proper, the type of economics that we do, it has really two purposes, I think. And one is to just educate people in general to understand how the world works. And I think it will, if you have basic economic understanding or economic literacy, which most people do not today, then it's going to help you to not be fooled. You're not going to be as gullible. You're not going to believe all the crazy things that people say, and you're going to be able to lead a better life. You're going to be able to have a better personal financial situation, all of those things, because you just don't fall for all the BS out there, right? So it's better for most people. And then you have the sort of tiny fraction of professional economists that we have today who can continue to elaborate on the theory and provide more understanding. But I don't really see this big army of people with, say, a master's degree in economics. And I mean, there are good people with master's degrees in economics too, of course. But all these people with that kind of advanced degree, but who are not really social theorists and who are not going to write these magnum opuses or contribute, but they're going to just run data and everything. We don't really need all of those. And I think in general, they would be better off and their employers would be better off by them studying statistics and not economics.
Yeah.
So economics would do much better going back to its roots. Or I think we've probably gone way too far already. So we might not be able to save economics the discipline, but instead we see a lot of expansion in other disciplines like my own entrepreneurship, people starting to accept reasoning about the market process. And of course, if your focus is entrepreneurship, you understand that it can't be general equilibrium that is the starting point, because the whole point of studying the entrepreneur is that it's not. Right. And so it's a different starting point. And of course, entrepreneurship scholars are pretty economically illiterate still, too, but they're at least willing to learn and they don't believe that they know it. So there's plenty. I'm very optimistic about proper economics, but not the discipline necessarily.
So to tease that out, you think maybe economics is too far gone and we need to rebuild it? It may be in other venues.
Yeah, absolutely. I think so. And I think very often you have really, really good educators. So you have like one in each economics department or something like that. And they're not, people look down on them because they're not doing research and things like that. But they are keeping the teaching evaluations up for the department and they're already tenured. So no one can do anything about them and things like that, right? And students appreciate those people and they go through the way of thinking about the supply and demand curves, because they have to still teach the mainstream stuff. And they contribute a lot because they they create this passion for understanding the economy, even though they don't have exactly the right tools. All the others in economics departments, I mean, they want to get rid of them just like they got rid of the economic historians, right? Because economic history is nowhere to be seen anymore, at least in the U.S. And they got rid of them because they don't contribute to research. And same thing with these teachers in economics. But I think they are something to do. We talk to them and communicate with them because they actually contribute a lot to real sound economics and economic thinking.
Well, final question for each of you. What is your normal response when young people ask you about either majoring in economics or even going all the way and getting a PhD in economics? How do you respond to that?
Wow. My first response is why? Or rather, I would ask them, to what end? What are you trying mm-hmm. to achieve? And I think a problem in Austrian circles is often that we're sort of married to the term, just like we were back in the day married to the term liberal, which we lost, right? And married to the term libertarian, even though practically half of Congress is now called libertarians in the media. So we might get rid of that term too, right? But it's not really a matter of prestige in the rest of the world that you are a trained economist. It's actually the other way around, right? If you're an economist, they go, oh, you're one of those, right? So it's not actually necessarily a good thing. And if your aim is academia, which should be the case for a lot of Austrians, at least, seeking a PhD, why do you want a job in an economics department just doing math and data mining instead of doing Austrian or Austrian-inspired stuff and making double the salary in the business school? I mean, those are your options, but you don't get to call yourself an economist. So a lot of people might not want to do it just because of that. But really, is not being a trained economist worth, I don't know what the difference in salary is, but 60 or 70 grand a year mm-hmm. throughout your career? Probably not. You should try something else. And I think we should have a lot more people who might not go for a PhD and instead become public scholars or public intellectuals and engage in discussions in general instead. You don't need a PhD for that, of course.
Yeah, my response, Jeff, when someone asks that is similar to Pear's, that I'm trying to just figure out, because a lot of times it's just they say, I just love this stuff. Like, I absorb all the Mises lectures. I've been to Mises U. This has to be a part of my life. And so I say, okay, well, you can go have like a regular job and just read this on your own. Because if you go even to a department where there's other Austrian economists on the faculty, it's not like your standard coursework is going to be just reading Rothbard and whatever all day. That, you know, it might be like on the side, you might get a micro professor who allows you to do a term paper that quotes Rothbard, but you're not going to learn Austrian economics per se. Even like at rare places like Hillsdale or Grove City, you know, when we were there, it was like when I was there, there was a two sequel, you know, Austrian one, Austrian two, but the rest of it was free market, but it wasn't Austrian. And so I'm just, I tell them that, like, to make sure. So if it's like, yeah, my job needs to be, I go into work every day and teach other people Austrian stuff. Then I say, okay, but that's a very narrow track. And, and Walter Block has a list of friendly schools that you would go to. But just keep in mind that even there, your dissertation for you to get hired somewhere, it may involve a lot of statistics and things that you don't even consider to be economics. And you're going to have to do a lot just to get through the hoops. Are you sure you want to do that? And some do, and we need people to be doing that. I'm glad they exist and we have them, scaring around teaching people to keep the tradition alive in academia. But I think Pear is right that it's not obvious. And yeah, I think mm-hmm. there is a certain thing like, well, no, Mises and Rothbard were economists and that's what I need to do because I got to be like my heroes. And, the situation is different now.
Well, listen up, kiddos. And also there's the opportunity cost known as your 20s. Which you will probably spend skulking around some college instead of buying a Ferrari with all that sweet Bitcoin money you should have been making. So we are going to link to a couple of things. First of all, you have to own this book. If you don't own this book, we mock you. So go to Mises.org. I can even arrange to get you a signed copy of this by the author. our guest today, Herb Island. I can make that happen for you. And also, we'll go ahead and link to the now infamous debate between the late Dr. Gary North and Dr. Walter Block on whether or not you should get a PhD. And it's broader than just econ, it's PhDs in general. So all that said, I want to thank Bob and Per for their time. Hope everybody has a great weekend.
Check back next week for a new episode of the Human Action Podcast. And in the meantime, you can find more content like this at Mises.org.